for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Americans received a string of good news last week. The lowest unemployment rate since late 2008, the stock market hitting all-time highs, corporate profits on an upward tear. But some analysts advise putting off the celebrations, at least until we see how sequestration cuts might affect economic growth. Joining me in the studio to talk about the U.S. economy, Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream, Damian Paletta of The Wall Street Journal, and joining us from an NPR studio in New York, Edward Conard of the American Enterprise Institute and a former partner at Bain Capital. I invite you to be part of the program. Give us your thoughts, your ideas. Call us on 800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, gentlemen. Good to have you with us.
Nice
to
be with you, Dan.
Good morning.
Damian, let me start with you. Remind us about the good news and then why people are saying don't be too optimistic.
Sure. I mean, we've been in this economic wilderness for almost 5 years now. But finally, you know, the stock market's at an all-time high. The housing market's come back. That was a lot of pain for homeowners all over the country for so long. Jobs numbers are improving. We've had several years of really weak jobs growth, and corporate profits are up. And so the one thing that that can do when people keep hearing about this is it can really get consumer confidence back, and people go out and they redo their kitchen or they buy a new car. They feel better about sending their kids to college, that sort of thing. So on the one hand, that's been really positive, but there's still a lot of, you know, clouds hanging over the economy. Long-term unemployment is still a huge problem. People that have been out of work for 6 months or more have a really hard time getting back into the workforce. They're the ones that tend to draw down their savings the most quickly, obviously. The number of people on food stamps hit a record in December 2012. That's a huge issue as well. And the sequester, we don't really know what these spending cuts are going to do later this year, but there's a lot of warnings that it could hurt economic growth and could cost jobs as well. So a lot of concern there.
So, Ed Conard, how do you interpret last week's news out of Wall Street and the Labor Department?
Yes, I think you have to reconcile the bond market with the stock market. If you look at the bond market, what you see is low interest rates out as far as the eye can see. That suggests that the bond market predicts very low growth for quite some time to come. When you look over at the stock market and see the highs, you kind of scratch your head. But I think there is an explanation for that, which is that investors see high profits, a lot of money sitting on the sideline. They don't see the kind of competition between companies that you would normally find at this point in the cycle, where they begin to compete for market share. They invest money, they hire employees, they lower the price of their product, and that pushes the profits from investors, from corporations and businesses, out into the rest of the economy, consumers and workers. You don't see that happening, and so I think what's happening is that investors are looking at the high profits. They expect a lack of competition for quite some time to come. They see low interest rates for a long time to come, and they start capitalizing the high prices at very low interest rates, and you see the stock market hit highs. I don't think it's necessarily an optimistic sign, although that's certainly one interpretation of it.
Hedrick Smith, how do you see it?
Well, I think, Diane, the critical thing, critical thing for me is that we're two Americas, and I think when you listen to Damian's numbers, you heard that. Corporate profits for the last 4 years since the bottom of the recession, 2008, have grown an average of 20% a year, 20.1% a year. At the same time, average family incomes, the incomes of average families, have grown 1.4% a year. So you're seeing two economies here. The stock market is hitting records. But at the same time, you have 22 million people looking for full-time jobs. Either they're unemployed or they're working part-time and they want full-time work, or they've dropped out. It was one of the big figures in the recent jobs report was 130,000 people dropped out of the job market. One reason why the unemployment rate came down is they left the market because they didn't see jobs. This has been our pattern for about 30 years. We've had ups and downs, but the reason I talk about the stolen dream, who stole the American dream, is there was a period in American history when the economy improved, corporate profits went up, we had economic growth, and the rising tide lifted all boats.
And right? The Second World War.
Yeah, but it continued for 30 years. It wasn't just immediately after the Second War. Of course, after the Second World War, we were strong. Our enemies were destroyed. Even our allies were destroyed. It took them 15 years or so to get back into the ballgame. But still, through the 60s and 70s, we had widely shared prosperity. When, for example, when productivity rose from 1945 to 75, just about doubled, rose 97%. The median family income rose 95%. So almost dollar for dollar, they went together. But the last 30 years, productivity has gone up 80%. An average family income, median family income has gone up 10%.
So
the average people are not sharing in the growth. So when you see these nice numbers, you got to find out who's benefiting. And you've got these two economies, these two Americas.
Damien.
One of the things that's really tricky and hard to put your finger on is the herd mentality that happens with the stock market. You know, what happened in late 2008 when the stock market really plummeted is you had a lot of not just, you know, big banks and stuff like that, but a lot of, you know, regular investors in their 401k saying, get me out of here. You know, I can't afford to lose all this money. This is the savings for our retirement, the savings for our college, our kids' college. Now you wonder if folks are going to say, well, maybe we can get back in. You know, maybe things aren't as bad. We want to be part of this upswing. And, you know, that brings both promise and peril. You know, obviously, we don't want people to put all this money at risk again. But on the same token, if you have people investing and they're making money, they go out and spend more money, consumer confidence goes back up. And then maybe we can help bring some of the people that are trying to get jobs, more jobs, because there's more demand for their services.
So, Ed, do you see perhaps short-term outlook, more consumer spending? What do you see?
Well, I think there are two possible scenarios. I think we obviously should expect some improvement from where we are. But I think there are two scenarios. One is that you grow off a permanently lower base coming out of the financial crisis, which I think is the more likely scenario. So you can get to full employment at lower wages, and you can grow at a robust rate off a lower base. The question is whether or not we'll rebound back to where we were in 2007, 2006, leading up to the financial crisis. I think we've identified real structural problems that have not gone away. It's a little bit like realizing you live in an earthquake zone. You're going to dial back your risk-taking to compensate for that. And so I think you'll see a recovery off a lower base and not a rebound back to where we were before, which would drive wages back up to where they were before. One minor point I would make is only that I think we are talking a little bit about the difference between the short run versus Hendricks, who was talking about the long run, and there are different issues at stake there.
How do you see the differences, Hendrick?
Well, one of the things I'm struck by is the analysis of economists both in this country and elsewhere that inequality, kind of inequality of income that we now have in America, is bad for the long-term growth picture. The short-term picture, I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on the short-term. All the factors that Damien mentioned, I would agree. We've got a better employment picture. We're worried about, Congressional Budget Office is saying that the sequester is going to cut 750,000 jobs this year. Some of the stories I read over the weekend were saying, look out in April and May, things don't look so good. I don't think people know. But what you do have is fundamentalists. You have economists like Joe Stiglitz at Columbia University, of people like Philip Aguillon at Harvard University, saying that there are study after study showing that when you have high inequality of income, as we have in America today, Citigroup called it the greatest inequality of income since Spain in the 16th century, that you get low growth, that high inequality of income is destructive to growth. It's a drag on growth. You get the best growth when you have greater equalities, or not equality of income, but closer incomes. The reason being, it's consumer demand that drives the economy. When people are paid low wages, you have low consumer demand. The driver of the economy isn't creating the jobs that we want. So you have industry sitting there. I mean, Damien's saying, well, maybe if people are feeling good and the consumer confidence is up, maybe they'll go and spend. Mm. But you also have businesses. There was a story in the New York Times just this last week saying that businesses, even like Google, are taking much longer to hire. They have 4 million job vacancies, and there are 12 million people unemployed. So you could match the two. You'd think it would work. No, they're taking longer. They're taking a month. They're taking 23 days when they used to take 10 days, 15 days to fill a job. So you've got that uncertainty out there. I'm safer if I don't hire. if I'm running a company, so I'll wait.
So let's talk about the sequester, Damien, and where those cuts are most likely to hit.
Well, the biggest concentration of the cuts is in defense spending, and that's not just buying missiles and aircraft. I mean, all sorts of different defense programs all over the country would be affected, and probably the most visible impact is close to 700,000 Pentagon employees could be forced to take unpaid leave.
Furloughs.
That's right, furloughs, probably one day per pay period, so one day every 2 weeks, and that's not going to begin till the end of April, we expect. So, you know, it's not going to be a dramatic cut in pay, but it's maybe a 5% of their paycheck. And if you have, as we know, there's a lot of military families where both parents are civilians in the military, so they'd both have their pay cuts, their paychecks
but
cut.
But we're not talking about members of the armed forces.
That's right. But we're still talking about 700,000
civilian
workers. That's right.
And I wonder how you see that, Ed. How is that going to affect the outlook generally?
I think you have to step back and look at the big picture. So there are several factors which play off against each other. One is the sequester, which next year is forecasted to cut spending $85 billion. Keep in mind, we're raising mandatory spending $85 billion, and we're increasing aid for Hurricane Sandy by $60 billion. So spending next year in 2013 is actually going to be higher, it's projected to be higher than it is in 2012. So only in Washington does that count as a spending reduction. It's actually a spending increase. The second thing I think you have to recognize is that we raised taxes about $180 billion at the end of 2012, $125 billion payroll tax on the middle class, $65 billion on upper incomes. And so, you know, this is half the size of the tax increases.
All right. Edward Kennard, he's at the American Enterprise Institute. Short break here. Right back. Welcome back. We're talking about current economic conditions with the rise in the stock market, the number of jobless folks, the whole housing market. All these conditions seem to look good, but there are concerns about where the economy is headed. I've got Edward Kennard. He's on the phone with us from New York. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. He's also a former partner at Bain Capital. He's at an NPR studio in New York. Damien Paletta is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hedrick Smith is author of a new book, Who Stole the American Dream? He's also a former Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. Damien, you were talking about full-time as opposed to part-time.
That's
work.
Right. I mean, one of the things we've seen a lot of is people that lost their jobs during, you know, 2008, 2009, the downturn. It's not like when we add these jobs every month, these people are going back into the same jobs they had before. A lot of people are being forced to take part-time work where they had been salaried with benefits. So they're, you know, the $10 an hour that they're getting now goes a lot doesn't go as far because they have to pay for health care and a lot of other benefits.
I think the other thing is, I think you were talking earlier about consumer psychology. You got to remember where people are now. Homeowners in America lost $6 trillion while the housing boom was going up. Now, home ownership and the equity that people have in their homes for middle-class people is the main source of their wealth. $6 trillion. We were pulling $750 billion a year out of home equity, either taking home equity loans, refinancing our homes, borrowing against the mortgage. So you're sitting with people who used to own 70% of the value of their homes, now owning 40% of the value of their homes. They don't feel economically secure. So when Damien's talking about going out and remodeling the kitchen, he's talking about the top 10%. You start to get down into the middle 50%, 60%. Those folks are feeling very insecure. They now are financing their 401ks. It's been a huge burden shift. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year have gone off the corporate books onto the pocketbooks and checkbooks of ordinary Americans. So people are feeling insecure. This is, yes, they're looking at things getting better. But if you take a look at what happened right after January 1st, Walmart is one of the best indicators of where the American economy is. 100 million people shop in Walmart every week. Okay, right after the payroll tax went up. Now, we're talking about the tax increase on the wealthy. That's where all the attention in the media went. But at the same time, very little attention went to the fact that the payroll tax went back to where it was before. Sure. It went up 2%. Walmart sales fell sharply in January. That's reflecting
Here's
that.
Here's an email saying, I think the state of the economy depends on where you are in the economy. People who already were doing well are now doing even better. The rest of us are struggling.
There's no doubt about it. If you were able to invest money in the stock market in 2009 when it kind of bottomed out, it's doubled since then. I mean, that's a good return on your investment. But if you got out of the stock market or were never in the stock market in the first place, you haven't seen any of this recovery, and it's a real challenge. I mean, we've talked to people every day who are having a hard time living paycheck to paycheck. They're not even living paycheck to paycheck, and this doesn't feel like a recovery for them.
And Ed, here's a question for you. Why is there such a big gap between the so-called winners and losers, and how might we regain some stability for those in the lower, middle, and lower classes?
Well, there are differences, different forces at work, I think, in the short run versus the long run. Let's talk about the short run, which is where Damien and I have been talking, although I'd love to talk about the long run. Normally, you get a shock to the economy, and you've discovered that there's either more risk than you thought there was, or you have less equity than you thought you had. And you end up with a shortage of equity, and people dial back their risk-taking. That lowers economic activity. Unemployment rises. With a surplus of labor and a shortage of equity, what you see coming out of recession normally is that wages will fall and return on investment will rise. And that is what we have seen here, although we've seen it in the extreme. I think the question you have to ask is, why is it that businesses and investors aren't taking the risks that push those profits back out into the economy and ultimately increase employment, raise wages, and lower prices of goods to consumers who are largely workers and their wages is the other side of the coin? You haven't seen that here. I believe that's in part because we see a lot more risk today than we saw in 2007 when we didn't really understand the banking industry and the risks that were there, and we haven't taken the steps to mitigate that risk. And then the government has tried to paper over that by spending more money with pretty radical monetary policy, and the effect of those things is to have further dial back in the private sector. They look at those policies. They don't really understand them. They worry that they destroy more value than they create in the long run. And I think it's very problematic for the private sector and the growth and the employment that you hope to get from it.
Diane, there's been a tremendous shift that's occurred in the business leadership in America over the last 30 years. If you go back and look at what Charlie Wilson, who used to run General Motors, biggest corporation in America at the time, Reginald Jones, General Electric, Frank Abrams ran Standard Oil, New Jersey. If you looked at what they had to say, they said our job, I'm thinking about what Mr. Kennard has just said and the risks and who gets rewarded here, their belief was that you should share the wealth, that the economy worked better, in fact, that the company worked better. If the stakeholders in the corporation That is, the groups that had a stake in the success of the corporation. The owners, of course, but the managers, the employers, the suppliers, the creditors, the customers, the communities in which they operated. If the stakeholders all shared, and we had a sharing of wealth, which was much greater at that time, we've now moved to what's called shareholder capitalism, which is why what Damien said is just true. If you were lucky enough or smart enough to invest in the stock market when it was at the bottom or just stayed in, then you've come out and you're back to where you were or maybe better off. If you got in at that time, you're really well off. What we had in 2011, believe it or not, the top 1% in America actually got more than 100% of the gain of the entire nation's economy. And the other 99%, everybody else lost money. Now, that has to do with not just the way the market operates. That has to do with the way the spoils are divided by the leaders of American corporations. It has to do with the way the laws are written, the tax laws. It has to do with things like the minimum wage.
It has to do with the way Congress operates.
It definitely has to do with public policy.
Here's an email from Michael placing blame, and I want to see if you all agree. He says, my small business cannot afford much more of this obstructionism from the Tea Party, both nationally and here in Florida. I feel like I've been dragged through the dirt for the last 5 years. Just when we start to get a glimmer of hope, now we have the economy killing and job killing foolishness of the sequester. Do you agree with that, Damien?
The Tea Party's influence is sort of complicated right now, and we're going to kind of see in the next 2 months how much influence they still have. Obviously, the election, some people viewed as kind of a rebuke of their influence, but the Republicans still control the House of Representatives, and the Tea Party has a big influence there. And so I think both Democrats and Republicans are reevaluating their strategy with the budget. You know, we have another debt ceiling issue in July or August. So, you know, the Tea Party folks that we talk to say, listen, we just want to cut spending. We need to get this under control or our country's going to go bankrupt. And so they're going to just keep pushing that issue. And they're going to have plenty of opportunity to do that because we're going to have to be debating these budgets the next few weeks.
Hedrick, how much is sequestration likely to make matters worse?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but the Congressional Budget Office says that we're going to lose 750,000 jobs, and it's going to cut about 0.5% on growth this year. They've got lots of experts. And there's similar estimates in the private sector from that. You know, what's interesting, back to the Tea Party, in the first place, it's amazing to hear a small businessman come out and criticize the Tea Party, because normally the political alignment is different from that. But what's interesting is Washington is disconnected from the country. If you look back, the election of 2012 was fought about jobs and growth. We have been absolutely consumed with the federal budget. You would have thought the election of 2012 occurred a century ago. We're actually talking about the agenda of the election of 2010. This is not to say that we don't need to deal with America's deficit. But the way to deal with it is over the long term. In the short run, we need stimulus. We need push for growth. We could be building infrastructure. We could be doing a lot of stuff. And we should be cutting over the long term in order to put our long-term fiscal house in better order.
Of course, we haven't even talked about how sequestration is going to affect low-income people, rental subsidies, food subsidies,
child care subsidies, things like that.
Go ahead.
I really think, though, when you look at the CBO forecast on sequestration, it talks about a slowdown in growth for a couple of quarters. And then it talks about the permanent damage that the deficit does over the long run. But what's missed in this conversation is that we have added $5 trillion of debt since the beginning of President Obama's administration. It's forecasted to add another $3 trillion with sequestration. That's $8 billion. When interest rates return to normal, we're talking about a $500 billion a year increase in interest payments. That will have a profound effect on long-term growth, and it will have a profound effect on the middle class and the working class and the poor in the country, because it requires either enormous tax increases or spending cuts. And so we can always focus on this. We need stimulus in the short run. We need stimulus in the short run. But we have to remember that every economist agrees that that does more damage in the long run than it helps in the short run. So if you have a little Keynesian temporary low in risk taking, a little bit of detriment to the long run in order to avoid unemployment in the short run is probably a beneficial thing. But we are 5 years into this. We're still trying to paper over a permanent structural problem with government spending and monetary policy. And we are beginning to do enormous damage to the long run. And you're seeing that show up in the stock market and in companies that are looking forward, expect no rise in the interest rate because there's no growth, are incredibly reluctant to hire employees, and are incredibly reluctant to compete with each other because everybody focuses on the next quarter. If we don't have stimulus, the next quarter might go down. You all sound like corporate managers. What we care about here is the long run and sound financial policies and monetary policies, which will maximize growth in the long run and get us off this low base and return us back to where we were prior
all
to
right.
2007.
Hedrick, you have another view.
Well, you can't get to long-term revenue increase until you get to growth. And you do need – I can read economists that contradict what Mr. Kennard said every day, saying you do need short-term stimulus in order to get the economy going again, which will generate the jobs, which will generate the consumer promise, which will generate more profits, which will generate more hiring. The economists call that the virtuous circle of growth. You need to get that going again. And that's been missing. And so austerity in the short run is a mistake. I don't think Mr. Kennard, listening to him, would advocate that.
The government will not create a virtuous circle of growth in the private sector.
Okay. Edward Kennard, he is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Yeah, I got a pretty basic comment when it comes to the Main Street economy. If we want to get the Main Street economy back to somewhat normal levels and sustain it, we have to get Wall Street out of the picture. I mean, if you look throughout history, most of the problems in the economy, when it goes up and down, it's all because of Wall Street, either directly or indirectly. I mean, the current housing crisis is a glaring example of it. And also, we need to change the shareholder laws in this country where the majority of the shareholders decides what these clowns on Wall Street make.
All right, Damien.
Well, Wall Street's got such an interesting role in the economy right now. I mean, obviously, we need these banks to lend money. I mean, they're the biggest source of credit in this country, and so we need them to kind of help the economy get its juice back. But there's still so many issues we hear about once a week or once every couple of days of some kind of goofy thing that a bank did or some big mistake they did, or they're in the Justice Department's crosshairs for one thing or another. And so, you know, they haven't done much to kind of repair their image. So, you know, it's hard to say we can just get rid of Wall Street because Wall Street's just part of the economy right now, but at the same time, they aren't doing themselves many favors.
You can't get rid of Wall Street, but our problem isn't shortage of capital. Business has been sitting on $2 trillion worth of capital for the last 4 or 5 years.
Not
hiring. And there was another story I saw in the paper about a month ago, which said that venture capitalists had raised $1 trillion of capital from pension funds and large investors, and they couldn't find places to invest it. Capital shortage is not our problem.
All right.
No, this is a misinterpretation, though, because there's two kinds of capital. There's risk-averse short-term capital that ends up in the banking system. It's all sitting idle because we don't have enough equity to underwrite the risk. When you say that venture capital has raised $1 trillion of equity, they've gotten commitments for people to invest. But what you find is that there's been an enormous dial back in risk-taking in the economy, and that's why venture capital can't find good places.
And why is there a dial back in risk-taking? Because there's uncertainty about consumer demand, and there's uncertainty about consumer demand because middle-class people are not getting paid enough money to be willing to go out and buy and do some of the things Damien was talking about at the beginning.
I don't disagree with you, but government spending won't solve that problem. It's a temporary bandage that does long-term damage.
We've received a number of emails saying the Department of Defense furlough is going to be one unpaid day every week, not every
20%.
What's your understanding?
That's interesting. I mean, I know that different agencies are going to handle it differently, but maybe that's going to be even more impactful.
All right, let's go to Paulette in Cleveland Heights, Ohio.
Diane, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
It's such a popular show. I'm amazed I got through.
I'm glad you did.
Yes, I would like your guests, if possible, to address two things. And all of this goes hand in hand with what you've been discussing. The emphasis seems to be on job creation, which is a good thing. But when companies such as one of the very large banks, and I can't remember which one it is going to let 4,000 people go across their network. And every time you hear about a job being let go, it's not 10 people or 20 people, it's hundreds and thousands at a time. I don't know how we're going to create so many new jobs to restore those. So I'm wondering, why can't they emphasize job retention along with job creation? And perhaps the private sector can furlough people. I'm old enough to remember layoffs when times were bad.
Sure.
They would let people go for a week or two
right.
and then call them back and save some money.
Right. I think the problem has become greater productivity, and the banks that are letting people go have found other ways to accomplish what they need to accomplish with fewer people.
Especially by hiring overseas.
Exactly. We've got to take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
The U.S. sees an average of 1,000 tornadoes a year. The history and latest research on American twisters, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Hedrick Smith, you wanted to go back to our last caller's question regarding job creation and job retention.
I think job retention is a very interesting question. One of the issues is where is your manufacturing sector? People are talking, is the manufacturing sector coming back? Can it come back? Should it come back? We've been told, you know, we're now in the service economy era, manufacturing's dead. Well, it's interesting to take a look at some other countries, Germany in particular. 9% of our workforce in America today, we've retained 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. Germany has retained 21% of its workforce.
How come?
I'm going to tell you in just a minute. Let me just tell you a couple more things about Germany that are interesting. German wages for middle-class German workers have risen 5 times faster than they have in the United States in the last 25 years, since 1985. Remarkable. You would think they'd be in terrible. Let me finish. Mr.
But that just can't be true.
Hold on, Ed. Let him finish, and then I'll come to you.
And what's interesting, 25 years, 1985 to 2010. And in the decade from 2000 to 2010, We had a $6 trillion trade deficit in America, and Germany had a $2 trillion trade surplus. Now, what they've done is they've found a way to retain jobs, which is what this woman is talking about, particularly high-end, high-pay jobs in the manufacturing sector, and they've managed to export. They've done it with cooperation between management and labor. They've done it with cooperation between the public sector and the private sector. The government helps a great deal with German exports. They've focused on high machine tools, high engineering, very precision products such as the BMW, such as the Mercedes-Benz and so forth, Airbus, whatnot. They've adopted a different strategy, which is much more like the stakeholder strategy that we had at work in America in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
All right, let's let Ed have a chance.
Yeah, I think this is a real mistake in thinking. If you really look at German statistics, if you go back to 1908, for example, 1998, I have the statistics in front of me. Germans' real personal income per capita grew about 5%. The U.S. grew 15% over that period. Today, disposable incomes in the U.S. in 2007 dollars was about 31. Germany's is about 21. If you look at the countries like Germany and Japan, which exported and tried to drive their growth off of manufacturing, they have grown significantly slower than the export, than the import-based economies have grown. And if you look at the U.S., contrary to popular belief, we pulled 14 million immigrants into our workforce. We didn't outsource. On net, we insourced employment. And so everybody turns to Germany. The way Germany succeeded is they had the government worked to lower wages across the board in Germany to try to get Germany more competitive, to get the little bit of growth that they've been able to get out of their manufacturing sector. The manufacturing sector is not a good place for us to stake our employment on, because the productivity gains have been faster there than any other sector in the economy. Even China is having a difficult time growing their manufacturing employment because their productivity gains are faster than the world is consuming manufactured goods. If you look at the economy since World War II, we have grown eightfold. Physical inputs have grown threefold.
Okay.
The slowest growing sectors of the economy are the physical sectors.
I want to take another call, but to let you know that Edward Conard is the author of Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. Let's go to Tampa, Florida, and to Dolores. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I have to wonder, as we keep talking about what has happened in the United States with small recessions over the last 40 years, and so many people who are supporting the top 2% never go back any further than that time. They always emphasize how much the government is causing this or is not doing anything to recoup from the recession. Why don't we hear the truth about what Roosevelt and the federal government did to get us out of our worst financial situations, which was the Great Depression? You don't hear anything about that.
I think you have heard something about that this morning, Dolores. I'm going to turn back to Hedrick Smith.
Well, I mean, the argument is, at least of some economists, obviously Mr. Conard doesn't agree with them, but the argument of some economists is, in fact, the stimulus package that we had in 2009 should have been two or three times the size it was. We could have then had some sustainable growth, and we wouldn't be talking about the kind of problem we're talking about today. We do have a structural problem here. The woman is right. I mean, if you look at the length of time it took us to get out of recessions up to the 1990s, it was about 18, 20 months. Recession of the early 90s, it was 21 months. Recession of 2001, it was 46 months. We're now into a recession in which we're in 48 months, and it's probably going to be 60, 65, 70 months before we get to unemployment to the same level.
Damn.
So we got a structural problem here.
One of the concerns you hear from a lot of economists also, though, is that when you get debt levels up to where they are now in this country, your hands are tied. You don't have as much flexibility to go out and pump money into the economy, because at a certain point, the financial markets are going to no longer finance that kind of activity. So, you know, there are some medium-term and especially long-term risks with the debt level that this country is holding right now, and that's the debate that we're having right now.
What happens when the Fed begins to pull out the banking industry?
That's the big question I think that everyone's trying to figure out right now. I mean, there's obviously, both on a personal level and on a federal level, there's a lot of risk if interest rates start to go up. I mean, obviously, they'll have to go up at a certain point, but it could really snowball the amount of debt payments that the country has to pay on all the money that it's borrowed. But also, it could have an impact on business and homeowners as well.
All right, let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Tina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, and it's kind of a comment slash question. My husband has a small business, which is very successful, and I have a really good job. And all of our peers make really good money. They're pharmacists, doctors. You know, we do really well. But one thing that I haven't heard commented on when we're talking about stimulating the economy, when we're talking about people spending and stuff, all of my friends, all of our little group, and maybe we're too small to count, even though we do have money to go spend, even though we are doing quite well, we just don't go spend a lot of money. I mean, we don't have a really large house payment. We've decided to stay in a smaller home. We don't have car payments. We don't go out and just go shopping and spending and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, does that have any impact on the economy at all, or are we just a small portion of the population?
Ed Kennard.
Yes. It's funny because she's personifying the very school of economics which I come from, which is called rational expectations. She looks forward into the future and she sees a high degree of uncertainty, and so she is more cautious today immediately. And I think that when you advocates of stimulus, they all point to the $700-800 billion one-time stimulus. But in truth, we have run about $1.2 trillion a year deficits for the last 4 years. We're going to run an $850 billion deficit this year. That doesn't count the $500 billion of interest that we're not paying because the interest rates are zero. So the school of stimulus spending never agrees that the amount of stimulus that we have pumped into the economy has been enormous, and it has had almost no effect at all, because the other school, from the Keynesian school, rational expectation, says that the private sector looks forward into the future. They see enormous interest expenses coming and enormous tax increases or spending cuts. And as this woman described, they dial back their economic activity today to compensate for that. And you can get not into the virtuous circle, you know, but the vicious circle, which is she holds back, more money sits idle, the government steps in and tries to borrow that money and do more stimulus spending. As the deficit grows bigger and bigger, she dials back more and more, and you never get any benefit from it. So I think it is very difficult.
I think, but rational expectation is something that she can afford to do. She said she's talking to and living among people who are doing very well. They have jobs. They haven't lost their jobs. I can remember in the middle of the recession going out to dinner on Saturday night in Bethesda and Chevy Chase and looking around at the restaurants. They were all jammed. People were buying very nice meals, ordering wine, having drinks. And I'm thinking, there's no recession. The Pew Charitable Trust did a survey in the middle of the recession, 2010, and they talked to people about what had happened to their lives as a result of the recession. It was a very interesting poll. And what they found out was that some people had seen their stocks come down, the value of their houses come down, and they were curbing their spending a bit, as this lady described, this woman described. Other people were in desperate shape. These are people who were borrowing from their family, couldn't afford medical care, couldn't make their housing payments. They'd lost jobs. They found out that the dividing line was at about $75,000. They headlined the poll, "One Recession, Two Americas." And that's what this woman is describing. The people who are making $50,000 a year can't afford to do what this woman is doing. They are spending all their money, and they're spending it at Walmart
just
in order to stay even. So when you start to look at the behavior of the people who are in the top 10%, and I would bet, just listening to this woman, her family's in the top 10% of income earners in the country, their behavior is quite different from the behavior of people at the bottom 90%.
Damien, I keep hearing that, and you've said it this morning, corporations are sitting on these piles of cash, and they keep claiming risk is what's keeping them from hiring. Hasn't risk always been a part of the investors' decision.
Sure, I think, but the number of self-inflicted wounds that this country's had in the last couple of years has been amazing. And the problem is every 2 or 3 months there's another tornado or a hurricane cloud on the horizon. And so, you know, you can't, in some extent, you can't blame them for wondering what Washington's going to do next to just monkey up the economy.
But nobody can predict what the weather is going to do. Nor can they predict what the Congress is going to do.
Right, but when the Congress and the White House are kind of vowing that they're going to be at loggerheads, then we've kind of learned lessons that, you know, maybe they're going to do this.
Do you
all over
see again. A change coming there?
I think that everyone kind of exhaled after the election, and I think both sides have kind of rethought their strategy a little bit, and especially the White House can't afford, you know, this is his last 4 years in office. He doesn't want to have this legacy of fighting with Republicans on the Hill. And the stock market's coming up. Maybe he sees this kind of Clinton-esque kind of revival that he might be able to enjoy. But the problem is that, there, like we've been talking about, there's a lot of folks that aren't enjoying this rebound. There's a lot of problems that are in the near term that need to be addressed, and it's going to have to be debated very soon.
And here's an email which says, I'm 60 years old. I work 40 hours a week for city government. I make $30,000 a year. Inflation does not allow me to buy products and support our economy. Gas prices, taxes, and food are up. We drive worn-out vehicles. New clothes are a thing of the past. We cannot save. We spend it on our electric bill.
She is describing the stealing of the American dream. You've got corporate profits at record levels. Corporate profits have a larger share of America's national income than at any time since 1950.
And Ed, the wage level. I'd the be wage interested in how Ed responds to that email.
Yeah, look. I do think that, I think there are two different Americas. I think that the America today is very different than the America in the 1950s when capital investment was really the primary driver of growth. Today, it's a very innovation-based, entrepreneurial-based growth, which has been beneficial to the people at the highest end
at the
wage scale.
Right.
So I don't disagree with that, but I also think that if you look at the U.S. relative to Europe and Japan, who are living in the same world, we added 40 million jobs on a base of 100 million employees since 1980. They had less than half as much. We grew 63% since 1991. They grew less than half as much. Our median wages are 25 to 30% higher than their median wages are. Our hours of work per working age adult are 35 to 40% more than theirs
All
are.
Right.
And there's been an enormous increase in middle class income. It's been spread over a large increase in employment relative to Europe and Japan.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The issue becomes, what difference does it make if the folks in Japan and Germany are doing what they're doing somehow, and Ed just acknowledged, there are two separate Americas right now.
Well, so the email you got was from a 60-year-old who's making $30,000 a year.
$30,000.
They're within 5 years of Medicare. I mean, the social safety net was designed for someone just like this, right?
Of course.
But those are the issues. I mean, we have 10,000 people turning 65 every day. These people are just moving into these programs in herds, and it's like they almost weren't designed to take in the number of people that they have. And so that's kind of one of the fundamental debates this country's going
to All right,
face.
To Hudsonville, Michigan. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks. I just have a quick comment. I keep hearing this debate that goes on, and businesses don't hire employees because they have extra money, unless or until there is demand for products and services. Businesses won't hire. So if the middle class had money to spend, then businesses would see that the demand for their products would go up. But every time I hear this debate, and you don't, you know, they say, well, corporate America is sitting on this many trillions of dollars. Unless people have dough to spend, the businesses are not going to hire. And I have one last thing I'd like Mr. Kennard to answer or to respond to. Why is it that every recovery on record in this country has gone along with an increase in public employment, except for this one? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, very quickly, Ed, please.
So two things there. So the reason is because the government spending is at 24% of GDP and it's running out of capacity to continue expanding. It has historically ran at 21% of GDP. In the Clinton administration, for example, it got down to 18% of GDP. So there was more space for growth than you have found in this economy. But I also think it's a mistake to think that demand by consumers is really what drives the economy, because it's always a chicken and egg thing. Work is what creates demand. And there are two kinds of investment. There is investment where you build capital to meet growing demand, but there's also today, which is the primary source of investment, is innovation, which increases productivity, which creates products like Apple and Google and Facebook, which create their own demand.
I'm going to give you the last word.
But it isn't just products. I had a conversation this past week with Klaus Kleinfeld, who is the head of Alcoa, used to be the head of Siemens. He describes how, as a German CEO, he worked very hard when products could be built more cheaply in Czechoslovakia or somewhere else in the world to retrain the workers. It wasn't just innovating new products. It was innovating new workers and having the workers take part. That's how you keep the American dream going.
Hedrick Smith, his new book is titled Who Stole the American Dream? Damian Paletta is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Edward Conard is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. He's a former partner at Bain Capital. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.